Good morning, everyone. We couldn't hang with you guys last night till 1 in the morning. Sorry about that. But good to have Evan here. Evan Gregg is in the house. Yeah. Our families go way back to even before Evan was born. And we've been friends ever since. And it's a very special thing. Evan's sister was just in my son's wedding. And, you know, it's very cool. It's great to have you. Staying overnight? Way to go. Good job. Let's start this morning with, I want to just do a quick recap of what we're talking about, because this is really counterintuitive stuff to talk about, the way of the incarnation being just as important as the fact of the incarnation. What are we talking about? It's hard to even describe. So this morning, I'm going to use visual pictures and story pictures to help us, which is kind of like the way Jesus did, telling parables. And don't you like how I just compared myself to Jesus? I don't know. Just kind of slipped out. Sorry. You should read my book. It's on sale in the back. It's called Humility and How I Achieved It. It doesn't exist, okay? I wrote one copy and my mom bought it. That was it. Let's start with page 10. Turn to page 10. Everyone have a booklet?
Here we go.
One right here. Oh.
You need one?
Some up here too.
Yep.
Hannah, since you're just like front and center, could I have you read this?
Sure. God, who created the universe in all its splendor, decided to reveal to us the mystery of the divine life by becoming flesh in a young woman living in a humble village in one of the small planets of God's own creation. Jesus' life was marked by an always deeper choice for what is small, humble, poor, rejected, and despised. Amen. The downward mobility of the incarnation. Our culture values upward mobility, staying on a secure career path, maintaining the status quo, appearing to others as an interesting person, succeeding in business, politics, sports, academics, or even spiritual practice. The world suggests to us in thousands of ways that we really should try to become the center of attention, being seduced into desiring to become an object of interest rather than a subject of compassion. The way of Jesus is radically different than the spirit of the world. It is the way of downward mobility. It is going to the end of the line, staying behind the sets, and choosing the last place. It goes against my inclinations, against the advice of the world surrounding me, and against the culture of which I am a part. Yet, it is the way to the kingdom and the way that brings life everlasting. The great mystery of the incarnation is how God descended to humanity and became one of us. At each critical moment of his journey, Jesus obediently chose the way downward, the descending path. We are called to follow Jesus on the downward path of ministry and to go to where God is leading, even if that place is somewhere we would rather not go.
Thank you, Nina. It's not exactly, you know, really an upbeat message. and yet, I think, like I told you last night, I've never really heard this taught, and this is not easy to teach the substance of what the way of God's incarnation is, and how that relates to how we can live every day, have a daily mindset, and is so different from the way the world thinks. It's the way different from the way my flesh thinks, the way I'm inclined to live and promote myself. It is counterintuitive, and it's difficult to understand. So that's why today we're going to use more examples and parables. I don't think the kingdom of God was easy for anyone to understand. That's why Jesus spoke in stories, in parables, because that engages your imagination, engages your heart, engages a vision, imagery, that then can penetrate us at a deeper level. Would you agree with me that the message of God's incarnation is just as important as his method of incarnation? I think we would all agree with that, but what do we mean by that? Because I think that most of what we're taught is about the message of incarnation, which is amazing. You know, God became man at one point in history, and it's the hinge of history, and everything changed. You know, God revealed himself. He had one shot, like we talked about last night, to just say, this is who I am. This is what is the important thing about me. I'm going to demonstrate that to you in real life, in real time, rather than just by sending a message through someone else, which he had done through prophets and whatever. But I think when we looked at Hebrews last night and Colossians, it said that Jesus is the exact representation of who God is. Not some imitation or copy. He's the exact representation of who God is, and that he's the visible expression of the invisible God in Colossians. That is not just talking about the first half of that's not just talking about the message of the incarnation, of knowing the facts of what God did for us and to die on the cross for us, become sin for us. We can say all those things and have all the right answers and still not understand the way that message was delivered in the way of Jesus, the way he was among us, the way he still is with us, that God became one of us and he was Emmanuel, God with us. His witness was witness. And then he left his Holy Spirit, who now his witness is in us. And he dwells among us, dwells inside of us. And we take that everywhere we go. And it is just as important, the way that we deliver Jesus, our methodology, our strategy, our way to understand God's way of delivering his message. My generation, I feel, did a disservice in many ways to that message because of the method that my generation used. And this is somewhat of a generalization, but I live among neighbors and friends my age, and my ministry is to my neighbors, people I live among, and not through the church. And there are so many people that don't understand who Jesus is at all because of the way the church has presented him. We've become a consumer church, consumerism, consumer-based church, just providing goods and services, Christian goods and services. My generation was into megachurch. My generation was into stadium events, just bigger is better idea. My generation was really into commingling politics with Jesus' message. And I'm actually really encouraged by your generation. I'm really excited about your generation. I work with a lot of 20-somethings, Sarah and I do, in this one place in Denver. And there's 14 young people that live on this really cool 8-acre property while they're going to grad school and stuff. So if anyone is going to grad school in your 20s and want to come and live for $200 a month and live in this really cool 8-acre place, let me know. It's called the Downing House, and you can't find it on the internet. It's under the radar. Anyway, let me know. But I love the way that your generation thinks about Jesus and thinks about living Jesus out in front of the world. And it's I think it is more combining the message of Jesus with the method of Jesus. And I love that. We want to combine that message. Is the greatest story ever told. God is with us. He's with us not just as we should be, but as we are. He goes to the deepest places within us and stays there and lingers there long enough until you want to walk out together. He goes to those places of shame. He goes to those places of guilt. He goes to those places that are dark. And he is with us. Someone once wrote that the 11th commandment is, thou shalt not should on yourself. He doesn't love us. He doesn't linger with us just as we should be. Just as you are sitting here this morning. And do we give that message? And give that message of love to those who we rub shoulders with, who God has brought into our lives? Is the message and the method the same? And so I'd like to, the first parable I'd like to read is this, settle in for a good story, okay? It's from a book called Love Does by Bob Roth. Has anyone heard of this or read this? Yeah, this Young Life guy. All right, settle in. This chapter is called I'm With You. I used to want to fix people. Now I just want to be with them. When I was in high school, I met a guy named Randy. Randy had three things I didn't have: a Triumph motorcycle, a beard, and a girlfriend. It just didn't seem fair. I wanted all three in ascending order. I asked around and found out Randy didn't even go to high school. He just hung out there. I had heard about guys like that, and I figured I should keep my distance. So I did. Later, I heard that Randy was a Christian and worked with an outfit called Young Life. I didn't know much about that, any of that stuff, but it helped explain the beard and made it okay that he was hanging out at the high school, I guess. Randy never offered me a ride on his motorcycle, but he tried to engage me in discussions about Jesus. I kept him at arm's length, but that didn't seem to chill his interest in finding out who I was and what I was about. I figured maybe he didn't know anyone his age, so we eventually became friends. I was a lousy student and found out that I could take a test to get a certificate, and that was the equivalent to a high school diploma. I couldn't figure out how to sign up for the test, though, which on the reflection was a pretty good indicator that I should have stayed in high school. My plan was to move to Yosemite and spend my days climbing the massive granite cliffs. At 6'4" and 220 pounds, I didn't really have a rock climber's build. I wondered what made me think there was a rock climber in me. When you are in high school, you don't give much thought to what you can't do. For most people, that gets learned later. For still fewer, it gets unlearned for the rest of life. At the beginning of my junior year, I decided it was time to leave high school and make the move to Yosemite. I had a down vest, two red bandanas, a pair of rock climbing shoes, $75, and a VW bow. What else did I need? I'd find work in the valley and spend my off time in the mountains. More out of courtesy than anything, I swung by Randy's house first thing on a Sunday morning to say goodbye and let him know I was leaving. I knocked on the door, and after a couple of minutes, Randy answered. He was groggy and bedheaded. I had obviously woken him up. I gave him the rundown on what I was doing, and all the while, Randy stood patiently in the doorway, trying his best to suppress a puzzled expression. You're leaving soon? He asked when I had finished. Yeah, right now, actually, I said, and I straightened my back and barreled my chest just to show I meant business. Look, Randy, it's time for me to get out of here. I just came to thank you for hanging out with me and being a great friend. Randy kept his earnest and concerned face, but he didn't say a word. Oh, hey, I inserted. Will you tell your girlfriend goodbye for me, too, you know, when you see her next? Again, no words from Randy. He had this weird, faraway look on his face, like he was looking right through me. He snapped back into our conversation. Hey, Bob, would you wait here a second while I check something out? No sweat, Randy. I had nothing but time now. What did I care? Randy disappeared for a few minutes into the house, while I stood awkwardly on his porch with my hands in my pockets. When he came back to the door, he had a tattered backpack hanging over his shoulder by one frayed strap and a sleeping bag under his other arm. He was focused and direct. All he said was this, "Bob, I'm with you." Something in his words ran right with me, right through me. He didn't lecture me about how I was blowing it and throwing opportunities away by leaving high school. He didn't tell me I was a fool and that my idea would fall off the tracks on the way to the launch pad. He didn't tell me I would surely crater even if I did briefly lift off. He was resolute, unequivocal, and he had no agenda. He was with me. Despite this kind of gesture, it was pretty odd to think he wanted to come along. Sure, I guess. I said half-heartedly, "You sure?" "Yeah, Bob, I'm in. If you wouldn't mind, what if I caught a ride with you?" Randy stood with a determined look. "So, let me get this straight. You want to drive to Yosemite with me right now?" "Yep, that's right. I can find my way back after we get there and you get settled in." I'm not sure why I accepted Randy's generous self-invitation. I guess it's because it caught me totally off guard. No one had ever expressed an interest in me like that before. "Sure," I stammered, as we both stood awkwardly on the stoop. "I guess we should get going then." And with that, Randy closed the door to his little house, and he walked side by side to my VW bug. He plopped into the passenger seat and threw his stuff on top of mine in the back seat. We got to Yosemite before nightfall. And it occurred to me, for the first time, we had no place to stay. We had a couple of sleeping bags, no tent, and very little money. So we snuck in through the back of a platform tent set up at one of the pay-per-night campsites. We slept toward the back so we could make our escape if an upstanding tent renter showed up for the night. Fortunately, no one came, and the next morning we woke up to a chilly but glorious morning in the Yosemite Valley. To the north of us, El Capitan soared 3,000 feet straight up like a huge granite soldier. Half Dome dominated the landscape to the east. These were my companions. This was my cathedral. I was in the valley-wide living room of my new home. Now it was time to get a job and settle in. I rolled over in my sleeping bag, thinking about how great it was to have Randy with me. I was a little nervous, but also excited about my newfound freedom. I was a man now. I felt my chin for any sign of whiskers. Nothing yet, but I shaved anyway, just in case. Randy and I dusted off the stiffness that comes with tent camping and went to the Camp Curry Company cafeteria. I thought I could get a job flipping pancakes in the morning, which would leave the rest of the day to climb. I finished the job application in front of the manager, handed it to him, and he gave it right back, sternly shaking his head no. He didn't even pretend to be interested, but I was secretly thankful he at least humored me enough to let them apply. No matter, undaunted, I went to one of the rock climbing outfitters with a storefront in the valley. I told them I'd do whatever they needed. I was sure that what I lacked in experience I could make up for by what I lacked in maturity or raw intelligence. They said that they didn't have any work for me either, and their jobs were tight and almost impossible to get in the valley. I walked out of the store discouraged and looked at Randy, who was leaning against the VW. Rather than feeding my discouragement and saying, "I told you so," Randy fed my soul with words of truth and perspective. "Bob, you can do this thing if you want. You have the stuff it takes to pull it off. These guys don't know what they're missing. Let's try a few more places." And then, just like he had said the day before on his porch, Randy reiterated his statement, "Either way, Bob, I'm with you." His words gave me tremendous comfort. I applied at nearly every business in the valley and struck out every time. There was simply no jobs available, no hope of one opening up soon. The evening approached as the sun sank low in the hills. It was one of those sunsets displaying the kinds of vibrant colors that would have made a painter's canvas look overambitious. But I was still heartened. The sunset was real. I was in Yosemite, my friend was with me, and I still had a shot at my dream. Randy and I headed back to the campsite and snuck into the same tent he had commandeered the night before. I didn't sleep well or long as I sorted through my very short list of options. There was no work, I had no money, I was a high school dropout, Randy snored, and I had to go to the bathroom. That about covered my list of problems from least to greatest. The next morning came with a crispness that only fueled my anxiety. Randy stirred next to me in his sleeping bag, gave a couple of phlegm-filled coughs, and said it in a much too cheery voice, "Let's go climb some rocks." We headed to the foot of one of the monolith cliffs in Boulder for a couple of hours, talking trash to each other about who was the better climber. By midday, we headed back to the valley to see if any businesses had miraculously decided to expand their operations overnight. It felt like the shop owners had quietly met somewhere when they learned that I was arriving in the valley and were conspiring against me to dash my dreams. The same rocks I had come to climb were now beginning to look like barricades. I applied at the remaining small storefronts I hadn't tried the day before. Do I even need to waste my breath to tell you what happened? Randy and I sat on the front bumper of my VW bug and leaned back against its flimsy and slightly rusted hood that buckled slightly under our weight. The sun was getting low in the valley again, and the grand cliffs I hoped to count as neighbors were casting long, dark shadows on the ground, each of them deepening shadows pointing toward the road exiting the valley. I only had a few bucks left after buying gas, and Randy offered to spring for dinner. As we walked back to the car after eating, I turned to Randy and said, "You know, Randy, you've been great coming with me and everything, but it looks like I'm striking low. I think what I'll do is head back and finish up high school." After a short pause, Randy said again that what had become a comfort to me throughout this trip, "Man, whatever you decide, just know that either way, I'm with you, Bob." Randy had been with me. I could tell that he was with me in spirit as much as with his presence. He was committed to me and he believed in me. I wasn't a project, I was a friend. I wondered if maybe all Christians operated this way. I didn't think so, because most of them I had met up until that time were kind of wimpy and seemed to have more opinions of what or who they were against than who they were for. Without much more discussion, Randy and I exchanged a silent look and a nod, which meant we were done. Without a word spoken, I hopped in the driver's seat of the car. Randy hopped in the passenger seat and followed the path cast from the long shadows the day before. I was back. I was going back. I didn't talk much as we left Yosemite Valley, or for much of the way home for that matter. A dream of mine had just checked into hospice, and Randy was sensitive enough to know that I needed some margin to think. We drove for 5 or 6 quiet hours. Every once in a while, Randy would check on me in his confident and upbeat voice. "Hey, how are you doing, Bob?" He pulled down some familiar streets and into Randy's driveway. There was another car in the drive next to Randy's that looked like his girlfriend's. We visited often. We walked up to the front door and he opened it. I walked in behind Randy, uninvited, but somehow I still felt welcome. On the floor, I noticed a stack of plates and some wrapping paper, a coffee maker, some glasses. On the couch, there was a microwave half in a box. I didn't understand that at first. Had Randy just had a birthday? Was it his girlfriend's? A microwave seemed like a weird way to celebrate someone's arrival into the world. I knew Randy wasn't moving because there wouldn't be wrapping paper. Then, from around the corner, the other half of this couple bounded out and threw her arms around Randy. "Welcome home, honey." Then the nickel dropped. I felt so choked up in an instant. I realized that these were wedding presents on the floor. Randy and his girlfriend. Sorry. I've read this before, you'd think like, just read it. Randy and his girlfriend had just gotten married. When I had knocked on Randy's door that Sunday morning, Randy didn't see just a high school kid who had disrupted the beginning of his marriage. He saw a kid who was about to jump the tracks. Instead of spending the early days of his marriage with his bride, he spent it with me. sneaking into the back of the tent. Why? It was because Randy loved me. He saw the need, and he did something about it. He didn't just say he was for me or with me, he was actually present with me. What I learned from Randy changed my view permanently about what it meant to have a friendship with Jesus. I learned that faith isn't about knowing all the right stuff or obeying a list of rules. It's something more costly, because it involves being present and making a sacrifice. Perhaps that's why Jesus is sometimes called Emmanuel, God with us. I think that's what God had in mind, for Jesus to be present, to just be with us. It's also what he had in mind for us when it comes to other people. The world can make you think that love can be picked up at a garage sale or enveloped in a Hallmark card, but the kind of love that God created and demonstrated is a costly one, because it involves sacrifice and presence. It's a love that operates more like a sign language than being spoken outright. What I learned from Randy about the brand of love Jesus offers is that it's more about presence than undertaking a project. It's a brand of love that doesn't just think about good things or agree with them or talk about them. What I learned from Randy reinforced the simple truth that continues to weave itself into the tapestry of every great story. Love does. What pictures of incarnation were in that story? God's way, God's methodology. What are a few things that we're going to look at different pictures this weekend and ask ourselves, what is God's way? What did you see in that? What did you hear? Regardless of circumstances, just being with, but not as a show, right? If it wasn't an act, couldn't have been, right? What else?
It's a sacrifice.
What did Randy sacrifice? Time. First few days of marriage. In Randy's life? Yeah. He consulted his bride on that before he left, so it wasn't like he made a unilateral decision. So she was in on it too. How good was that? So.
He was committed and not judgmental about God's decisions.
Right, there wasn't an I told you so attitude when the whole thing failed. That's hard.
There wasn't any criticism either.
Pretty easy to say, I don't do this. Sorry.
Okay. I was saying he didn't like criticize him for anything, like, you know, thinking he was a fool.
Yeah. How do you have patience like that? Part of these stories we're going to hear this weekend, you ask yourself, and even with God, like, how can we even think that way? It's so counterintuitive. You know, everything in me would not have taken that trip. This is what we want to pray, to ask God to help us. After the end of each session on your sheet, I have kind of a prayer. Lord, help us unlearn our incarnation way of thinking. You know, which in this session is distraction and shallowness. We just distract constantly. And that, I think that keeps us from even thinking the way Jesus thinks about people. About investment in time. And we're just on to the next thing, in the immediacy of what's available to us. So, I mean, we need God to show us this way because it's not instinctual at all. If you all would turn to page 8, I just want to read a quote from my favorite writer. My favorite writer is Wendell Berry, and he's a farmer in Kentucky, and he writes, and he's 82, and Sarah and I just took a road trip out to Kentucky and saw him in his little farm kitchen, he and his wife, and I just thought, and he writes a lot about presence and friendship and neighborliness, and he's kind of changed the way I've looked at what my job and my life. And he wrote this: I take literally the statement in the Gospel of John that God loves the world. I believe that the world was created and approved by love, that it subsists, coheres, and endures by love, and that insofar as it's redeemable, it can be redeemed only by love. I believe that divine love, incarnate and indwelling in the world, summons the world toward wholeness, always toward wholeness, which ultimately is reconciliation and atonement or at one-ment with God. That's a lot to this thing, to digest. But I think Bob was the guy who wrote this, who's gone on to just have this incredibly adventurous life because he's now doing what Randy showed him how to do with people. In fact, he gives you his cell number in the back of the book. Like, and if you call him, he'll answer. How weird is that? Very weird. But God's love through Randy, demonstrated through Randy, summoned him, like Wendell sang here, summoned him to wholeness. And it wasn't an act, it wasn't phony, it wasn't just something where then, you know, a book could be written about it. There's a some, when we love people the way Jesus does, which is so different than the way we think, when we learn that way with one person, it summons wholeness. And as we learn God's grace and that God is with us, not as we should be, but as we are, and we learn how to accept God's love, we're summoned into wholeness. And then, only then can we offer that to someone else. You know, we can't fake it. We have to listen to this summoning voice, this not just the message of Jesus, but his method, and really luxuriate in learning about how he is with us. Every day of our lives. Let's talk about friendship now. Friendship, and then we'll talk about presence, what Jesus did with being present, listening, and seeing in new ways. First friendship, and Amy read our text, and I'm glad you read that next verse, Amy, that Jesus said, love one another just as I have loved you, and I call you friends. And a friend lays down his life. He lays down his life. And I no longer call you slaves. It's not like a working relationship. It's a friendship relationship. And it's undeserved. Frederick Buechner says that, you know, God called Abraham a friend. God called Moses a friend. And is it only for the patriarchs? Because they were studs? They were like these holy men? No. He said in this passage, Jesus is concerned with all of us. You are my friends if you do what I command you. What did he command us? To love one another. To love as he did. To be his friends, then, is is to say that we have to be each other's friends, conceivably to lay down our lives for each other. You never know. It's a high price to pay, and Jesus does not pretend otherwise, but the implication is worth every cent. To lay aside our privileges, like we talked about last night in Philippians, the descending path of God. So we're called friends, not because of anything we earn at all. It's totally undeserved. And we can love people that way too. God is relational by nature. You know that? I mean, he exists from, it's hard to wrap our minds around, from the eternity past to eternity future, and now he exists in community. That's his person, that's his personhood. He's relational by nature, and yet in his way in coming to man, coming to us, was I'm gonna do more with less people. And I think our methodology is I'm gonna do more with more people. And God said, no, I'm gonna do more eternally sustaining good with less people. And then have you infect the lives of others. And he befriends us for no good reason. And we can befriend others for no good reason. And we can confuse them with how we love people, with our holy curiosity in their life. We can confuse them with grace and kindness. Turn now to page 13. And I want you to read this definition of friendship. Heard this once, and I love it. A true friend is one who is delighted to see you and has no immediate plans for your improvement. Was that true about Randy with Bob Goff? Yeah, absolutely. Does this definition appeal to you? Does it appeal? What do you think of this? If it appeals to you, why does it? Say, as a giver. Either one, is that what you're saying? Are you asking me? What are you saying, woman?
She's saying, what do you mean? Like, does it mean to you as the friend or the person who's being friends with? Yeah.
I think both. I actually think, I wonder if this isn't have something to do with the way God loves us. We can receive this kind of love. Or do you feel like God's love for you is conditional? If you clean up your act, if you scrub up some areas of your life, clean out some closets, then we can talk friendship. Is that the way you see God? We often do. But have you ever been extended this kind of friendship by someone? I was in high school. In high school, there was this neighbor woman that was in her 60s. I thought she seemed like she was, 100 to me. You know, when you're in high school, guys like me look really old. But she was just the mother of this friend of mine in high school. And she was someone that I just couldn't wait to just, when I had nothing to do after school, here's a 15-year-old boy just wandering over to the backyard of this friend's, and seeing this friend's mom, and we'd sip tea on her back porch, and she just exuded this to me. She was always just delighted to see me. It was like I was the only thing going on that day. And we could just talk about anything under the sun. She accepted me just as I was. I was a mess of not knowing anything. I hadn't met Christ, anything. She was always just delighted to see me. And it wasn't about fixing me. And man, I didn't know it then, but she had just this love of Christ that just and she taught me that this was so attractive, and I just kept asking her questions about why, about life, and then why she would love me this way, because I was a nobody. Have you had anyone ever do that to you? Show you this kind of, they have no agenda for your life. They just love you. No?
Yeah. Yeah, growing up,
kind of love touches us. And if we truly understand, I think John was infected himself by God's grace. He was learning it, so he could give that to you. And it says they have no immediate plan for your improvement. But who's like that? But it's not that you won't improve, but it won't because of a program or an agenda. Or an expectation. It'll be because of love and unconditional acceptance. And then you'll go, oh my gosh, I want to. I desire. You remember the last verse of that prayer last night? Lord, give us the grace to desire it. To desire you more. To desire the endless. We don't even have the desire. We need God to pray for that. To give us ability to love this way. But there's no immediate hook or trick in why we would love someone or love our neighbor. We don't know how to do that. This is so counterintuitive. John, could you cue up that?
Which one?
The DVD. I think in this clip, I want you to be thinking about how chapter 15.
Right?
Yeah. Where do you see the incarnation in this clip from Forrest Gump? Was that everyone seen Forrest Gump? Or was that just my narration? Okay. Look for incarnation. Remember that scene? Where do you see incarnation in that God way? Maybe where do you see it through Forrest? How Forrest deals with it? What he does?
He stops talking. He quietly goes over and sits with her. He lets her process her emotion. And instead, he doesn't say anything. It's kind of like the book of Job. There's a lot of other stuff going on. But to see how Joe's friends have showed up, to say anything, that can almost be more powerful than this.
And what would you say? He sat down with her. He didn't stand over her, right? He lowered himself. Again, the descending path, you know. What else? Why is that an impact to see? As uncomfortable as it was, you can see him when she first started throwing stuff, he was like, what? But he didn't just let it happen. He was just He had that witness, right? Who does? Couldn't have understand the depth of what she was going through, but he could be with her. You know, he didn't have to be. I think for us sometimes when we're with someone in their pain, you know, we don't have words, we're not a counselor. But should that keep us from doing the incarnational way of love? It doesn't have to. We don't have to be professionals. We don't even have to have words. We can be present, we can truly listen, deeply listen, and we can see someone as God sees them. Those three things, let's talk just a little bit about for the rest of our session. Just being present, what that means, listening, what that means, it's a lost art. All of these things are lost arts. And really seeing someone the way God sees them. Turn to page 14. Okay. Talk a little bit more about presence. And how powerful presence is when we really receive it or give it in the Spirit of Jesus. And page 14, this is again from Henry Nouwen. More and more, the desire grows in me simply to walk around, greet people, enter their homes, sit on their doorsteps, play ball, throw water. I don't know what that means. It sounds good, though. I don't know. Maybe at a super soaker. And be known as someone who wants to live with them. It's a privilege to have the time to practice this simple ministry of presence. Still, it's not as simple as it seems. My own desire to be useful, to do something significant, or to be part of some impressive project is so strong that soon my time is taken up by meetings, conferences, study groups, and workshops to prevent me from just walking in the street. It's difficult not to have plans, not to organize people around an urgent cause, and not to feel that you are working directly for social progress. But I wonder more and more if the first thing shouldn't be to know people by name, to eat and drink with them, to listen to their stories and tell your own, to let them know with words, handshakes, and hugs that you do not simply like them, but you truly love them. This is a guy that taught at Yale, wrote a ton of books, but then decided to live the last 10 years of his life with severely disabled people in a community in Toronto. And he was just a brilliant guy. But he made some deliberate choices. But isn't that true, though, what he said about, you know, you can have all the well intentions in the world to be just to get to know people and spend time with people, but then you just get taken up with causes, these bigger things. And it's just easy to just let yourself sign up for more impressive things than just being with people. That's something that feels like a pull on us, and then we never have time to just know people by name, know children by name. And Saint Francis, not Saint Francis, but Pope Francis, the current Pope, said this. He said, "In our world, we're obsessed with the details of other people's lives, shamelessly given over to curiosity. But the church should look more closely at spending time with people. In our world, we Christians can make present the fragrance of Christ's closeness and his personal gaze. We do this through what's called the art of accompaniment. Isn't that a cool phrase? The art of accompaniment. Who would have thought that's important? It teaches us to remove our sandals before the sacred ground of love. The pace of this accompaniment must be steady and reassuring, reflecting our closeness and our compassionate gaze, which also heals, liberates, and encourages growth in Christ. Great, great word from the current book. The art of accompaniment. Just, this is something that everyone can do. We're not professionals. Here's another story. His name is Bill. He has wild hair, wears a t-shirt with holes in it, jeans, and no shoes. This was literally his wardrobe for his entire 4 years of college. He's brilliant, kind of esoteric, and very bright. He became a Christian while attending college. Across the street from the campus is a well-dressed, very conservative church. They want to develop a ministry to the students, but they're not sure how to go about it. One day, Bill decides to go there. He walks in with no shoes, jeans, his t-shirt, and wild hair. The service has already started, and so Bill starts down the aisle looking for a seat. The church is completely packed, and he can't find a seat. By now, people are really looking a bit uncomfortable, but no one says anything. Bill gets closer and closer to the pulpit, and when he realizes there's no seats, he just squats down right on the carpet. Although perfectly acceptable behavior at college, trust me, this had never happened in this church. By now, the people are really uptight, and the tension is thick. About this time, the minister realizes that from way at the back of the church, a deacon is slowly making his way toward Bill. Now the deacon is in his 80s. He has silver gray hair and a three-piece suit. He's a godly, elegant man, very dignified. He walks with a cane, and as he starts walking toward the boy, everyone is saying to themselves, well, you can't blame him for what he's got to do. How can you expect a man of his age and his background to understand some college kid on the floor? And it takes a long time for the man to reach the boy. The church is utterly silent except for the clicking of the man's cane. All eyes are focused on him. You can't even hear anyone breathing. The minister can't even preach his sermon until the deacon does what he has to do. And now they see this elderly man drop his cane on the floor with great difficulty. He lowers himself and sits down next to Bill and worships with him so he won't be alone. You know, who taught that guy to think that way? You know, it's not our first instinct. We need God's help to help us think in new ways. I bet that church was forever changed after that example. You can have all the sermons in the world, but then you have one demonstration, one actual demonstration of love changes everything. And that's why God did it the way he did it. Let's watch this, Sean. This is a little video clip from do y'all know that Young Life is in Africa now? It's in 24 countries in Africa. And they have summer camps for kids. And listen for what's incarnational in this little clip. What methodology do you see in that's incarnational? Anything strike you? The way they do the camps? Sorry.
It's inclusive of everybody.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Lydia said they pair up. The key thing, they're not just like having as many kids come to a camp as possible, right? A leader is already has done what Young Life calls contact work. You know, like here they hang out with kids at their ball games or whatever. They found kids in the streets. They hung out with them. They spent time with them. And then only when they've earned the right to be heard, earned trust, they can invite them to this camp, right? And then is that the end of it? Mm-hmm. No? They go back with that kid to their environment and keep spending time with them. It's not a program. It's life on life. And there's no shortcuts. This takes time. There's no shortcuts to being present and listening and truly seeing something. Anything else that struck someone? I don't know. Cut anyone off? It's exploding over there. And it's not just because they have cool camps. They're not like our camps here. You saw the camps. But there's a sense of an aroma of Christ, a belonging that they don't have. Let's talk a little bit about listening, the art of listening, and the art of seeing. In listening, a friend of mine wrote that here are things I'm learning about listening. Because I think we're really poor listeners in general. And it's an art, it really is. And there's an author named Parker Palmer, and Parker Palmer says that we can, as a verb, listen to each other into truth-telling about the condition of our souls. You can spend time with someone and truly listen deeply to their life. And this takes time. It's not like here's a formula or a technique. You can spend time truly listening, asking the next question. You know, if someone says something that promotes like a deeper question, you'll know prompting from the Spirit how to ask the next question. Why do you feel that? What is it about that? You know, tell me more about that. Tell me more. Use that phrase. Tell me more. Tell me more. Have holy curiosity. Like the Pope said, we take off our sandals in front of other people. When people do that to you, they want to know, they truly want to know more about you, it evokes trust. This author says, when I'm thinking about an answer while other people are talking, I'm not listening. I've never done that. When I give unsolicited advice, I'm not listening. When I suggest they shouldn't feel the way they do, I'm not listening. When I apply a quick fix to their problem, I'm not listening. When I fail to acknowledge their feelings, I'm not listening. When I fidget, glance at my watch, and appear to be rushed, I'm not listening. When I fail to maintain eye contact, I'm not listening. When I don't ask follow-up questions, I'm not listening. When I top their story with a bigger story of my own, I'm not listening. When they share a difficult experience and I counter with one of my own, I'm not listening. You guys ever done any of those? Yeah, Suzanne has done. We've got a lot of work to do with listening. Just listening alone, right? As an incarnational skill. We've got work to do there. Good question. And then finally, I just wanted to say something about seeing someone. Don't you love it when someone truly sees you? We have so many friends that young gal we just met, Sarah and I just met with, just has this longing that no one sees me. Truly sees me. For who I am. They only see what they want to see. They don't see me. First of all, we have to know that God is the one that sees us. And we have to be able to catch his gaze. 2 Corinthians 3:18 talks about that we hold God and gaze at him as in a mirror. That mirror is, so we're seeing ourselves in God. We're seeing ourselves the way God sees us. And then that transforms us in ever-increasing measure. It's an amazing thing. First, we have to see ourselves as God sees us. That unconditional love. And then we can gaze at others and see them as God sees them. Tim Keller said, to be loved but not known is comforting, but it's superficial. To be known and not loved is our greatest fear. But to be fully known and truly love is well like a lot like being loved by God, holding on and truly love. It is what we need more than anything. It liberates us from pretense, it humbles us out of our own self-righteousness, and fortifies us for any difficulty life can throw at us. No. So we all long for it. And we can extend to one another to be fully known and truly loved. When I vowed to marry Sarah. The scripture in Genesis is that our to become one with her will be like being naked and not ashamed. Completely vulnerable, transparent in front of one another. She knows everything about me and loves me anyway. She can only do that through God. And I know everything about Sarah. You've married to someone long enough, you know everything about me. And you ask God to help you love them anyway, as God loves them. And see them. That way. Not the way you don't accept them the way you hope they're going to be. But you learn how to love them as they are. I'm going to end with this quote from Marilynne Robinson. It's a book called Gilead. Anyone ever read Marilynne Robinson? She's awesome. Now in my present situation, I think you do have this on page 15. Okay. In my present situation, I realize there's nothing more astonishing than the human face. It has something to do with incarnation. Any human face is a claim on you because you can't help but understand the singularity of it, the courage, and the loneliness of it. I believe every human face, and these are my words, had a claim on Jesus. Every one of our faces are so unique, and they have a claim on Jesus. To gaze at you until you gaze back, bright-eyed and full. And we need to learn how to have that, give that gaze back, mirror that gaze back. And Thomas Merton says that the whole purpose of mentoring, and I think this is how God mentors us. He penetrates beneath the surface of a man or woman's life and get behind the facade of conventional gestures and attitudes which he presents to the world and brings out his inner spiritual freedom and inmost truth. That's God's goal with his way with you, his way with me. The way of the incarnation. And the goal is freedom. It's complete freedom. Now, I can show up in any situation in life as the same person. I'm going to show up as who God created me to be everywhere I go. I don't have to like wear masks. It's a freedom. It's awesome. I'm not there yet. But I've gotten a glimpse of that taste of it. If we could just end with just do what we did last night, just get together with a group of two or three or four, whatever, and I'd love to just have you just share with one another, and we won't come back as a big group, just share with one another was there a particular parable that you saw or heard that had an impact on you? This one. The prayer I end with on the end of this session is, Lord, teach us to unlearn the incarnational strategy of distraction and shallowness instead of attentiveness and presence. Lord, hear our prayer this morning. Teach us how to be undistracted. We're so distracted by how many Facebook friends we have, whatever it is. You know, instead of picking that one person that maybe you could be a friend to for no good reason. And it's not on social media. It's just God has presented that person in your life. But share with one another what visual, what parable impacted you with this incarnational stuff, and what skill of friendship do you want to learn, and how is that challenging to you to be present, to listen, to truly see and be seen? Just share with one another. What's challenging to you? Where do you want God to touch in you in this area? Okay? And then
up on the
close.